get our thermal underwear on right now. As I mentioned last week, that Arctic blast is coming down big time. Let's see, we got 31 degrees in New York, 22 degrees in Chicago. Boston's about 30. Wyoming's 15 degrees. And at nighttime, this is the daytime. At nighttime, you can drop that about 10 degrees on each of those cities. So, boy, Arctic freeze, Arctic blast. And I talked about it last week. Even out here in Northern California, we're dealing with some pretty icy times. And I'm getting ready to go to Paris, as I told you. I got to get my thermals, 30 degrees, cold, freezing. So never worn thermals, but now is the time to prepare. So I don't do well. And, hey, what I'm going to be doing is going to museums. And my travel partner, Deborah, and I, she's been there, but she said it's been a long, long time. And Paris is littered with amazing museums. There's one that I really want to see. It's the Rodin, the sculpture, the famous Rodin Museum. He's the guy that sculpted the Thinker, you know, the guy that's leaning forward with his fist under his chin, kind of wondering what's happening. But he's also well known for a whole bunch of other very fascinating sculptures. And there's an entire museum dedicated to him. Of course, my fascination with the ancient past, I'll be in the Louvre where they have a whole section on the Middle East. I think it's the third largest collection of Egypt artifacts. So I'll be spending a great deal of time there. And I'm going to post those photographs on the Facebook page so you guys can see what's interesting. There's a couple of pieces I'm particularly interested in which have quite unusual stonework. In fact, one is a sarcophagus that apparently has no evidence of any machining or any cutting. It's been polished to the degree where it's just, you can't see where the edges start and when they stop, and it's a wonder. It's one of those, I think it's probably it's a half ton, I believe. It's very, very heavy, made out of solid granite, and there's a lot of question about how it was made. So anyhow, there'll be a tremendous amount of photographs taken. I went out and purchased this attachment for my iPhone that allows you to shoot up to 5,000 photographs, and it's stored on an external chip. So every possible storage capacity, I'm looking at all of them so that I can take advantage of all the sites. So looking forward to it, and I'll be prepared. I'll be warm. So, hey, EA is... Earth Ancients is sponsored by Gaia, and Gaia is a real fascinating website, and I really appreciate them being our sponsor. If you haven't been to Gaia, they're offering a new program this month. For 99 cents, you can take a look at their entire category, their entire catalog, and film documents and original programs. There's over 7,000 original programs. And the program that they're offering for Earth Ancients listeners is Gaia. It's GAIA.com/Earth Ancients. And it's the Earth Ancients special. Sign up. It's 99 cents for the first month. And then after that, it's, I think it's like $9. But hey, check it out. I mean, if you don't like it, jump off. But 99 cents. That's really, really a great price to check out just a huge variety of content. I was watching the William Henry's Awakened Soul series, and it's quite interesting. Quite a lot of his discussion is on the transcending the mind, not getting out of our daily, day-to-day kind of focus and looking at the inner self through meditation. And he has a lot of really great things to say. But then, that's just one area. There's a new series by Corey Good and David Wilcox called Cosmic Disclosure, where they both believe that NASA is has a complete secret space program. And we heard from Mike Barra a couple weeks ago about his belief on that too. You can watch, that's a four-part series. And there's literally hundreds of topics you can imagine that are available on that. So check it out, gaia.com/Earth Ancients. It's really, it's kind of a cool deal too. I mean, 99 cents. Wow. That's like, hey, check out the website. You got to go to the Earth Ancients website and you need to sign up. It's earthancients.com. And when you sign up, you're going to get the newsletter, but you're also going to get some free stuff. I'm going to be throwing in another free ebook. I haven't figured out which one it is yet, but I'll announce it next week, which will be what, next week is the day before Christmas here in the States. And when you sign up, not only do you get on the list, but I'm going to be sending out more information, specific articles, and heads up content on what's happening in the future on Earth Ancients Radio podcast. And again, all the free stuff, because I get a ton of free ebooks. And the only way you're going to get that is to register. So go to the earthancients.com site, scroll to the bottom, and sign up. You want to do that. And also, I want to hear from you. If you're a listener new or you've been with us for a while, send me an email. Let me know what you're thinking of the show. And you can send me an email at cliff@earthancients, that's with an S, .com. And I need to hear from you guys. You know, I mean, there's thousands of people listening each week, and I want to know what's on your mind. What do you think about these topics we're talking about? Is there something that we're not covering? Are your answers being, are your questions being answered correctly? So give me a call. Give me an email. No, don't call me. Email me. cliff@earthancients.com. I want to know what's going on. Hey, the Path of the Sacred Maya tour is coming up, and I had a chance to talk with Miguel Angel Vergara, and he is the Mayan shaman who will be on the program with us. He's a fascinating guy. In fact, I spoke to him for about half an hour, and he went over some of the topics we're going to cover. We're going to tour the Yucatan, Mexico, April 2nd through the 8th. We'll meet in Mérida, and we're going to go check out some of the top locations in Yucatan: Mayapan, Chichen Itza, Ekbalam, Cova, and then of course the fascinating Uxmal, which is one of my favorite places. But here's a question. Here's Miguel. I asked him a question, and here's what he had to say about the buildings. I've been down to Yucatan. When I'm down in those areas, those buildings are very unusual. Not only the construction, but it seems like to me the Maya inherited their wisdom from a much earlier civilization. We don't know who. I mean, some people say the Star People. Yeah. Some people say the Maya came from Mu, Lemuria, or migrated from Atlantis. But is it to your understanding that those buildings are imbued with knowledge? In other words, those stones are resonating, and somehow through some form of science they have inserted knowledge that is only available when you do a certain type of technique or something. I mean, their science is on a Mayan science is on a whole different level
Yes.
Than our understanding of science. Can you talk a little bit about the buildings and what your understanding is for resonance? Well,
yes, it's a quite interesting question because has been, you know, there are quotes in the sacred book, the Maya Popol Vuh book, who they made reference to our grandparents from the stars, who they came here, the four grand Balams, you know, the Mumbalan Kitse, Balan Akab, Mahakuta Ikibalam, with their wives. So these people came from the stars to live with the Mayas, and the story said that they taught to them all about science, art, astronomy, mathematics, the Mayan calendars, and of course build up the temples. So the origin is from the stars. The origin of these constructions, temples, and knowledge, it's from the stars, from the Pleiades constellation. This is why the seven stars, the Mayans call the rattlesnake constellation, because you see now in the northern hemisphere, you know, like a little rattles, you know. So the Mayans said, we are the people of the serpent. And they call the Pleiades the Sapkan rattlesnake constellation, who has a connection. My teacher, Don Vicente, told me that at the beginning of the times, imagine Chichen Itza with nothing, just forests and the wells, you know, they perceive, of course, with another senses, the areas where the ley lines coincide. Mm-hmm. The pyramid of Kukulkan was built now, comproved scientifically, you know, over a cenote.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then we have one cenote in the north and one cenote in the south, with an underground river crossing exactly in the middle of the pyramid, connecting with the ley lines of Chichen Itza, with, you know, northeast, 17 degrees northeast. So this knowledge was a combination of the health of these people, but at the same time, the level of meditation, rituals, and ceremonies, and evolution of the beings of the Mayan people, who through the different generations transmit orally, you know, or through the Mayan books to the next generations, these astronomical mathematics, how to build up constructions like Kukulkan's pyramid or the temple of the Dorf in Uxmal, or the Kukulkan's pyramid in Mayapan, and many others. The Volcor at Chichen Itza, who is the representation of a great story of the Popol Vuh, the Xibalba story. So all this has a sense. But my teachers told me something, that in that time, the Mayas had a formula to make, to prepare the stones.
Like, I've been down to... So that's Miguel. That's just one excerpt from a short interview I did with him a couple of days ago. He was in Mérida, which is where he lives. And this is going to be a fascinating journey. He's going to be coming with us. We're only going to take about 20 people to this Path of the Sacred Maya. We're going to be down there April 2nd through the 8th. You can see the entire itinerary if you go to earthancients.com, and you'll see the big banner, Path of the Sacred Maya. Click that, and you'll see the day-to-day reference of these amazing sacred sites that we're going to. And there's so much we don't know about the Maya, but one of the things that is coming and becoming quite clear is that they understood the natural occurring earth energetics, geomagnetic fields, and chemistry that we just do not understand. And a great deal of knowledge has been handed down to Miguel, which he will discuss each day that we're there. So this is a great opportunity to be with a local native who's been there for decades, to climb these pyramids, to walk around, and to really get a sense of what these places are all about and this very, very ancient culture. So come on out and join me April 2nd through the 8th on the Path of the Sacred Maya. Hey, I always want to make sure everyone goes to the Facebook page, Facebook Earth Ancients, to the group side. And this week, there's a number of photographs on ruins in Machu Picchu, the famous Machu Picchu ruin. But also, we are highlighting one specific carving. It's in it's called Stone of the Moon. It's in Peru, Upper Cusco. And this is a fascinating piece of work because they don't have a clue how it was cut. It's cut into solid rock. A number of engineers have said that they believe it might have been a calendar, but they don't know how it was cut. It's a half circle, and on top of the circle, there's these different flat planes that are perfectly cut. It's cut with a machine of some kind. It's just perfectly cut. But anyhow, this photo gallery of Stone of the Moon is available on the Facebook page. And the photographer took probably six different angles of this surface feature that is magnificent. And I've not been to that part of Peru, but this is just, it's pretty amazing. And there's a tremendous amount of writing. People have posted their speculations on how it was done. To this day, the technology is so advanced, we have no clue. And I think I wrote a post in there that the only way we'll ever really be able to figure it out is if we develop some kind of scanning technology that can determine any kind of radiation or any kind of emanations that are coming off of this stonework. It's estimated to be thousands of years old. They just don't know. I mean, the Inca came to this part of the Peru. It was there already. So, and that's, you know, thousands of years ago. So very interesting. So go to the Earth Ancients, go to Facebook, Earth Ancients, go to group, and you'll see these photographs. You got to check them out. I mean, really each week there's a ton of photographs that we place there. Really interesting stuff. So most of you are familiar with the name Tesla. I mean, today there's an entire company that's built around Tesla, the electric cars that are produced in California. Although they're luxury cars, they're still 100% run on batteries, and they're pretty cool. I see them running around here. Nikola Tesla was born in Serbia, which is it's in the location of present-day Croatia. He was born in 1856. And he was a genius on many, many levels. He was an electrical engineer, a physicist, a mechanical engineer, and many people consider him a futurist. Created the alternate current, the AC, the electric motor, wireless communications, the radio. And I didn't know this, but he actually was the first inventor of X-ray. And these are just some of the things that we know about him. He has hundreds of patents, hundreds. I mean, the guy was just a machine to developing electrical machines, ideas, ways to tap electricity and move it through different types of buildings and things like that. He was so far ahead of his time. I remember reading that, and this was his own quote about how he thought about machines. What he would do, he would conceptualize a machine, okay? And then in his head, he would put it together and he would make it run. I mean, what kind of a brain is so developed that it can actually conceive of a machine, put it together, and then make it run? And he was actually able to actually take that idea and actually create the machine, and he knew it would run. That's how confident he was. But, I mean, that's a level of genius that we just have no concept for. I mean, that's somebody who kind of lives outside of our paradigm. And this is what I think the problem was with Tesla, is that he was so far ahead of himself that he may have frightened people, and I think he may have appeared to be arrogant to a lot of people. And when he first started, he probably was very he was received very well, but after a while, I think that he probably got under people's skin a little bit because he was just so far ahead of his time. But today we're discussing the genius of Tesla, and I actually found a short audio that I want to play here before we introduce our guests. And this is Nikola Tesla talking a little bit about his work.
Electric power is everywhere present in unlimited quantities. I can drive the world's machinery without the need of coal, oil, gas, or any other fuel. This new power for the driving of the world's machinery will be derived from the energy which operates the universe, the cosmic energy.
Now, if you look, he's speaking pretty quickly, but he's basically saying electric power is everywhere in unlimited quantities, which I find is quite fascinating. And so today, again, we're talking about Tesla, science of the gods. I believe that he was pretty far ahead of most of us today. In fact, he's probably 100 years, many hundreds of years ahead. My guest today is Dr. Tom Vallone, and Dr. Vallone is the president of Integrity Research Institute and editor of Future Energy Newsletter and E-News. He's authored 6 books, edited over 10 books, and written about 100 scientific studies. The 2 books I'm interested in today are, which he wrote, is Tesla, Electricity Unplugged, and Harnessing the Wheel Works of Nature, which were very fascinating reads. I think you would enjoy reading those. Tom, how are you today?
Good, Cliff. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for joining me. It's going to be fun. You know, Tesla has such a broad life in terms of inventing things. Was it one area that kind of piqued your interest and you decided that you wanted to learn more about them and you wrote these books? Or as a scientist yourself, was it more something of a curiosity?
Well, I grew up in Western New York, Buffalo in particular, and Buffalo was fortunate to be the first city in the world to receive electricity from 20 miles away back in 1896. So it was kind of an amazing process to go to Niagara Falls, 20 minutes away, and throughout my early years, I became very familiar with the Niagara Falls legacy, you know,
right,
showing the portion of the Adams plant, the Tesla statue, and the remaining portions that I actually have in the Harnessing the Wheelwork of Nature, the history of Tesla in Western New York. So he got under my skin. I joined the Tesla Society when that was still, the International Tesla Society was still going in the 1980s, and lectured on that topic, and also did my master's degree project on the homopolar generator, which Tesla also wrote a book article on called The Unipolar Dynamo. So he influenced my professional career quite a bit, including zero point energy. I quote Tesla's quotation about abundant energy being available everywhere in the universe in the beginning of that book.
You know, there's so much we don't know about some of the inventions he made. I mean, he has hundreds of patents, but this zero-point energy, anti-gravity energy forces and things like that, it appears that we don't know. It appears that he was working in a number of different physics that we just aren't well aware of. And I'm curious to know if you were familiar with any of these unusual technologies he was working with.
Well, as I say, the emphasis that he constantly seems to have about free energy, which is a concept that I pioneered back in 1996 with the Free Energy Race to Zero Point video, which is now all over the internet. That was a big project by itself. $70,000 was invested by a Los Angeles Lightworks AV Corporation. And we quote Tesla in the beginning of that video as well. So his concept that abundant energy was humankind's right and inheritance, I think, stuck in the minds of a lot of us baby boomers, thinking that the future 21st century would include that, just as we thought free air and free water was available.
Okay. No, it's just interesting because he states quite clearly that the Earth's magnetic field, and that there's an abundant amount of energy to be used, electromagnetics of the Earth. How did he understand it? How did he uncover that possibility? Did he have tools that basically allowed him to discern that there was abundant energy in the Earth?
Absolutely. In fact, a good starting point to answering that question, which is an entire lecture probably by itself,
yeah.
James Forum I give a lot of credit to because he's a professor emeritus from West Virginia University and constantly has been my idol in this field. I think he's probably the foremost Tesla expert in the world. He pointed out that Tesla discovered the Schumann resonance 50 years before Schumann did, and that was in Colorado Springs, sent a pulse of energy up into the atmosphere, Earth ionosphere cavity is exactly what it's called, and then waited for its return and recorded the speed at which it returned and also the resonant frequency, 8 cycles per second.
Interesting.
So that is a good proof of that. And the energy, in other words, is not only resonant, which is exactly what he always focused on, mechanical vibrational resonance in terms of buildings, but also in terms of the Earth. And that's what the Harnessing the Wheelwork of Nature book is focused on, showing that there are various PhD experts that concur with Tesla's viewpoint, including Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher, who was the first female professor of physics in Berkeley University. And she wrote an excellent article that's in the Harnessing the Wheelwork of Nature, pointing out that the magnetosphere and the ionosphere are like two sides of an oscillator, and they can share energy back and forth. And I found journal articles to back up her thesis as well. So it is interesting that if you, and as Tesla proposed, the ionosphere, the magnetosphere will back it up and amplify. The magnifying magnetic amplifier is Tesla's concept in that regard as well.
If you as a scientist were to look at Tesla's body of work, would you say he was 50 years ahead of himself, 100 years ahead of himself? Because obviously this understanding of Earth's energetic fields and tapping into it is pretty advanced, and I think I'm curious, and we're going to talk a little bit about this again, why we haven't pursued this. Obviously, it's not he probably, and I read this in a couple of books, that Westinghouse and Edison couldn't make money if it was free energy. Obviously, they couldn't tap it, they couldn't account for how much was in use, and they couldn't charge for it. So obviously, it's not something that is something they can market. But, what would you say about Tesla? Pardon me?
Yeah. J.P. Morgan is the quote you're trying to get to. Yeah.
Right.
He's one to blame.
And what did he say?
The J.P. Morgan, it's in the more than one movie about Tesla. The PBS channel just had a special on Tesla about 2 months ago, and in fact, there's a famous movie with Orson Welles as J.P. Morgan. And again, the same thing is: if I can't put a meter on it, then I'm not going to fund it. So he funded the first $100,000 of the Wardenclyffe Tower and refused to finish it because way he could meter all the people who would receive the power from the Wardenclyffe Tower.
Exactly.
And so he realized he can't make any money. Pretty much like the president-elect.
What was fascinating is that he funded this Wardenclyffe Tower, and I want to talk about that right now. Wardenclyffe Tower is a tower that draws its energy, I guess, from the atmosphere. Can you talk a little bit about it, what the application idea was? Because This was one of these future machines that Tesla built that is radically, radically different than anything we can even conceive of. Go ahead and tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. To begin with, I would like to give a plug for our institute. Integrity Research Institute was literally the only organization, for-profit or non-profit, in the world to celebrate the centennial of the Wardenclyffe Tower. In 2003, we had all the world's experts on Tesla come to the Washington, D.C. area for a conference, a Tesla conference that we held, to celebrate the Wardenclyffe Tower, which was completed in 1903 on Long Island. And the funny thing is, when you talk about how far ahead of his time was Tesla, well, at least 100 years. Because even in 2003, when I even prior to that, I tried to get Western New York to celebrate the 1995 centennial of the Adams plant, first, you know, electricity, AC electricity plant in the world, and nobody in Niagara Falls, New York, wanted to do anything. Only the power company had a little internal seminar that day. And so 2003 was a small conference, had limited media coverage, but literally, this was a concentrated effort to celebrate this amazing type of transmission of power. Well, unfortunately, as J.P. Morgan was successful in getting the half a dozen textbook publishers at the time to drop Tesla's name from the scientific accounting of his work, we've literally forgotten about Nikola Tesla's life. I've actually heard Tesla experts complain. They go to a lecture on Tesla, and half of the audience thinks it's going to be about the Tesla car. That's all the millennials know about Tesla. So it's really unfortunate. And Wardenclyffe Tower has been denigrated even as recent as the biography by a Virginia Tech professor saying that no one in the world understands how a Wardenclyffe Tower works. And this is only less than 10 years ago. About 5 years ago, he wrote the latest.
Well, it's such a radical thought. I mean, powering vehicles, boats. I mean, Tesla's vision for the technology behind the Wardenclyffe Tower is that it would shoot out, and I need you to talk a little more about it, but it doesn't it power cars and boats and airplanes that are all within the atmosphere?
Well, absolutely. And in fact, to make it believable, and I find that there is a real credibility gap here because everyone's literally used to the umbilical cords that J.P. Morgan forced on us. We have to get power from the wires that come from the pole. And luckily, in our last decade or so, we've been seeing a freeing effect of the television broadcast, the radio broadcast, cellular phones. You know, the trend is literally there. If you take an archetypal view of how mankind is evolving, we want the freedom of detachment from the mother load of energy. Mm-hmm. Although we still want to get benefit from all of it, all of everything she has to offer. So, of course, we're going to cut the umbilical cords as much as we can, but the Wardenclyffe Tower is probably the most challenging intellectually, even for scientists who should know better. Electrical engineers still prefer to say we don't understand it and dismiss it. First of all, you're talking about megawatts at least generated by one Wardenclyffe Tower. Now, how are you going to get megawatts through the Earth's atmosphere cavity without scorching everybody in its path? You know, that's the first thought that I get from audiences. You know, isn't this dangerous and so forth? Well, you have to look at the huge kilometers, square kilometers of space that you're broadcasting through. And Jim Quorum's already done that calculation in the Harnessing the Wheelwork. And then literally come to a calculation of how much per square centimeter. So we can dismiss the concern about it being harmless. Harmful. But the next issue is, if it's harmless, then is it worth anything? Can you collect it? Well, the beauty of Tesla's idea, which has now been crystallized in the Zenik wave discovery that Jim Quorum has literally exclusively announced through my book, Nikola Tesla's Electricity Unplugged, in the last chapter, he describes the fact that the ground current is the most important. And Tesla had already said that, even though the Earth on sphere cavity complements this oscillation. So, put a long story short, the essence is we're transmitting power level electricity through the ground mostly, Earth ionosphere cavity as well. And the last thing I need to emphasize is the receiver is resonantly coupled to the sender, to the transmitter. So this is totally different. As Jim Quorum used to explain, he says, we're used to things like radio being broadcast everywhere, and if you're lucky, you get a receiver that can pick up a weak signal. Well, Tesla's idea is totally different. You don't lose any energy unless the receiver literally resonates with a weak transmitter of a similar kind so that the circuits then are coupled. And then the transmission is received and literally very efficiently done, over 95% efficient, which is
So for those of us like myself who are not scientific, how does this tower work? First of all, what is the composition of the top of this tower? Because it looks like it's all kinds of probes that are in a circle that are round, and then there's this big tower that sits on top of a building. How is it drawing energy? Is it sending energy to receive energy? How does this thing work?
Well, the first of all, I need to change the concept that you have and everyone normally has, and that is when we see that strange skeleton of steel beams forming a hemisphere at the top of the Wardenclyffe Tower, most of us can't understand how that antenna could even function. First of all, you have to remember that the tower was unfinished, and the artist drawings of a completed dome is literally the final product, providing capacitor plate. And I need to emphasize that. The capacitor plate is essential to the Wardenclyffe Tower's functioning, along with the grounding rod that is literally a couple hundred feet into the ground. So the Wardenclyffe Tower you're seeing is like an iceberg. You're seeing part of the top portion, but the rest of the good stuff is down underneath the ocean, so to speak, just like an iceberg. You know, the majority of the important part is below ground. So just to emphasize the top of the dome, we basically talk about longitudinal waves. And longitudinal waves are totally different than transverse. And that's what Tesla said throughout his life. You know, Maxwell's transverse waves are wasteful. They're, you know, he had all kinds of derogatory things to say about Maxwell because the transverse E and H alternating waves that we're used to are dissipative. Instead, if you're using a longitudinal wave, you literally are punching like an acoustic sound wave. The same analogy holds, that you're pulsing forward with a wave front that propagates through the Earth's ionosphere cavity. And it becomes very like a soliton. It's very self-sustaining and very resonant with its cavity. So it doesn't dissipate. It's 95% or higher. And Tesla, 100 years ago in Colorado Springs, verified it was over 95% efficient. His notes show exactly the amplitude he received after he transmitted around the world.
Okay. But I'm still trying to figure out where. Okay, so here's this tower, and then inside this building is an engine, and then they've got it down. So how is the energy drawn up, and then how is it distributed? That's the question I have. Those are the basics.
Right, and that is that it takes an electro engineer to appreciate the details of exactly what you're asking. Just to teach community college for several years, and that helps because I can bring it down to the high school level sometimes. I try all the time, but, you know.
Okay, buddy, gotcha.
So, the analogies usually are the way to go, and first of all, picture a Tesla coil. I mean, Tesla literally invented the Tesla coil. There's a lot of electrotherapy benefits, which I can get into. But here we have a huge Tesla coil that he is specifically sparking at the time. It was 8 cycles per second. So he literally would be creating these blasts of longitudinal wave fronts 8 times per second coming out of the dome. Now, the ground current is also going to be resonating at a similar frequency, but the frequency is variable. Jim Corum discovered that there's another frequency in the kilohertz range that can amplify and optimize the Zenic waves through the ground. So that's essentially what you're doing. But one thing I can anticipate is the free energy question, which I usually get. And here we have to emphasize this is not intended as a free energy device. However, once you power your Tesla Wardenclyffe Tower with some conventional energy, which could be renewable, of course, then you've primed the pump, so to speak, so then the rest of the resonant complementary amplification, magnifying transmitter is Tesla's phrase, for what phenomena will occur after the stimulus hits the Earth.
Interesting.
And Andrew Puharich wrote a wonderful biography of Tesla. They were compatriots, and he described the magnifying transmitter being over unity as well. And that's in the Harnessing the Wheelwork of Nature book.
Now, obviously, if this tower is pulsing this energy, and from what little I've read about the receiving end of it, these automobiles and ships and airplanes have to have an engine and a receiving system built into them somehow. Is this a different kind of electricity than we're normally accustomed to? Because it must be, because otherwise we'd be zapped. Everybody on the ground would be zapped. So how does that work?
Well, the best that we've been able to determine, and I literally could anticipate answering that in another book, literally a third form trilogy of books, because the receiver is obviously the most important, but the transmitter in the Nikola Tesla's Electricity Unplugged, I felt, was the most important to start with. Of course, what you're asking is essential to getting utilities or private companies to take advantage of this discovery. Well, I have to give credit to Jim Corum, because he literally has partnered with a very knowledgeable team to form a corporation that will introduce that receiver technology to the world, and hopefully become profitable by doing that. So that's sort of the roundabout answer, but it's called Texzon, T-E-X-Z-O-N. The website is T-E-X-Z-O-N-T. For Texzon Technologies, .com, and they're located in Texas. That's where the name comes from. So Texzon Technologies is planning to build receivers after the transmitter has been proven, which he describes in Chapter 20 of the Nikola Tesla's Unplugged book, that the tests they've done so far have proven the concept works. Tesla was right. The energy can be transmitted through the world, literally through the ground of the world, and the distance is not a problem anymore. So we're going to see the electrical grid that we've always worried about, if you're an engineer, saying it's aging, it can't handle solar energy loads. There's a lot of concern with its vulnerability. All of that will disappear as soon as this new technology is available.
Okay. And so Tesla didn't conceptualize an engine that would be run from this energy. It was something that would come down the line. So we don't know really how the engine would work, but it would probably be a different kind of an engine, obviously, in that it would have to be receiving and have a storage unit for when it can't receive that energy, which is fascinating to consider.
If you don't mind, Cliff, because actually Tesla did conceive of it. He not only conceived of it so well that it became classified. I don't know if your listeners know that a lot of Tesla's archives were grabbed by the FBI literally within 24 hours of Tesla's demise. And in my harnessing book, you'll see one of the redacted pages, literally 2 days after Tesla's death, already summarizing what they had taken and where it was going. So this is an important point to emphasize, that Tesla did conceptualize very well what the receiver would look like. And on page 26 of my Tesla's Electricity Unplugged book, what I've done is not only found the reference, which is Tesla's patent 685954.
Okay.
That's the one to look at, because the receiver is right in there, and all the diagrams are described.
So that's the actual diagram for the engine, is what you're saying?
No, for the receiver.
Oh, for the receiver. Okay.
Yeah, that's what you asked about. So that's why I'm giving total credit to Tesla. Plus, there's more information about how the receiver is built and tuned at the National Archives Library, which I was fortunate enough not only to visit, but then meet a Black Project fellow who's retired, who said, yeah, I've been to the National Archives too. I was escorted in there to the back room where the Tesla classified files still are available, and there's a lot more information about the receiver that the public has not even known about yet.
Let's talk about these Black Projects. We do know, and you've already hinted at it, that when he died, his archives, his research, everything was taken by the FBI, and we don't know what they grabbed. But there is a tremendous amount of speculation that these so-called Black Projects, these top secret government run Black Projects, may have Tesla's signature on them. Now, there's speculation that some of these flying craft or anti-gravity flying craft could be based on his work. Do we have any idea? Can you speculate on any of that possibility?
Oh, flying craft?
Yeah.
Is that what you're asking? Well, I'm still focused on the electricity generation, but the anti-gravity and flying craft in general basically is another specialty, which actually I'm very excited about, and I give more credit to T. Townsend Brown for pioneering some of the electrogravitics that's involved in anti-gravity work. Anti-gravity is a misnomer, so I really don't give a lot of credence to that kind of concept. However, providing a unidirectional force that can be used in a very efficient manner rather than propelling things out the back like we're used to doing with rockets and even gasoline engines is definitely a futuristic concept. And that's what our institute emphasizes, energy propulsion and bioenergetics. So in the propulsion area, there are unidirectional inventions that we've been advocating and funding. We're literally funding a control moment gyroscope project by Mike Gamble, retired from Boeing. Boeing's been using that for years to keep the satellites up in orbit. Has anyone noticed that ever since Skylab crashed down into the atmosphere, there haven't been too many satellites that have lost their orbits, including the International Space Station? I'm asking a question of your listeners because we've forgotten the fact that you don't have too many falling, even though there's thousands of them up there. So Boeing has been using a paired force precessed gyroscope concept. Physicists say is impossible, but Mike Gamble built them for years, and now he's building a tabletop demo to prove it for us to concept. So electrogravitics are in the same mode and actually very exciting because you can use high voltage to propel things if you know the right elements to put together in the receiver.
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised to see a video of you speaking before, I think it was a Senate House Committee with Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project with, I guess, some other scientists. And you were talking about some of the craft that you have detected and some of the possible places where these craft were coming from. a good deal of the discussion was possible reverse engineered alien technology. We had Mike Barra on the show recently talking about ARVs, but would you say there's a good possibility that some of these dark projects are directly related to Tesla technology?
Well, he's given credit for a lot of them. I mean, literally, Tesla technology has become kind of a viral concept, and anything advanced in the energy realm, including propulsion, seems to have him tagged. But in general, I would say yes, just because it's in vogue to give him some historical credit. And but more importantly, the evidence for these ARVs and advanced projects seems to be overwhelming. Even the Science Channel now is having the NASA Uncovered, NASA series.
Yeah.
And they include some UFO stories periodically, which is very interesting to me because I'm seeing more channels now give honor to the very credible, the most credible UFO cases. But to really bring this up to date, which is what you're asking about, is the fact that a lot of these UFO sightings, including the one I just watched on this NASA program, had a few helicopters involved, which obviously were not unidentified to speak of. But in general, the emphasis is that ARVs are really black project reverse engineered vehicles. And you get into the discussion of, I've had very often as far as how many of these craft could possibly be ours rather than ETs. And it's open to speculation. You can. My reference to this initially was Mark McCandlish. Mark McCandlish was one of the speakers at the original disclosure in 2000 at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., and he has been an aerospace illustrator for years and constantly crossed the line into classified areas, gotten squeamish military guys that said, no, we don't want that, or, no, this and that, gave him irrational answers, and then he knew he was onto something. And the famous one that I had to fight tooth and nail to include his testimony in my book, Electrovitics 2, is the description of the Norton Air Force Base sighting, which was publicly seen in 1988, including a congressman. And that story is in page 131 of Electrovitics 2. And what Mark describes in detail, and I literally had Hal Puthoff, a famous physicist, contribute to the at least back research on this story, is that not only did they see three different hovercraft, but the hovercraft literally had 1950s rivets. So this kind of gives everyone the idea that nothing gets declassified until decades, literally about 50 years, has passed. And it happens at the patent office all the time, 4,000 to 5,000 patents in the vault, and the inventor usually has passed away by the time it's declassified. So the same thing is true with the Air Force. And these hovercraft were, and he draws the picture in the book. You'll see the illustrated mechanical drawing of exactly what was in the hovercraft. And it was interesting because it was a concept of pulsed electrovitics, which has been verified to produce a unidirectional force.
So electrogravitics is something that is a concept for an engine that you speak about in your books, or is it just the theory of it?
It's basically, I wouldn't even call it an engine necessarily. It's a propulsion or a force producer. It's literally a generator of propulsion that we don't really have a language to describe, because all you have currently in the public's mind is you can go see Dr. Strange or any number of other Iron Man. Iron Man has these panels in his hands that he can project a force from.
Right.
But we don't necessarily know what that is yet, but science sci-fi movies are already showing us what it should do. And that's sort of what Star Trek has done for us. The Star Trek series really catalyzed a whole bunch of technology because at least they showed you what it was supposed to do, even though it wasn't even available at the time they showed the movie and the TV series. So the same thing is true with this electrovitic force. It's a force that's produced by a certain, in this case, high voltage and capacitor plates that are very specifically arranged. And it has been verified by NASA. There's lots in my book that show the corroborated evidence of the force production. But the fascinating thing is this is a futuristic concept that can be used to get us to Mars a lot faster than anything else that we have available. Even the EM drive. I don't know if you know about the M drive, EM drive.
I think I saw a picture of the engine. Isn't it that it's a copper engine that they're saying is that's the M drive, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's a weak form of what I'm talking about. It's using electricity, or in this case, microwaves for the EM drive, to propel out a cone. It's a copper cone that's opening to the rear of the craft.
Right.
And it produces a very weak but a sustained force, and already NASA's investing lots of money in trying to upgrade its production capability. But this is the kindergarten of electrovitics, literally.
Okay.
But at least it's leaking out into the public domain.
So I mean, you study these craft, these UFOs, and you're with Stephen Greer's group, and which means that you have a good insight into a lot of this. This is a hard question, but I'm going to ask it of you anyhow. What percentage do you believe are Earth-based technology craft that are using these advanced propulsion systems, and what are off-Earth versions? I think someone told me, like Mike Barra, we had on the program, he believes that it's like 70-30, 70% are Earth-based reverse engineer, possible Tesla technology, and then the 30% is off-world. What do you say?
That's a pretty good guess. My Black Project contact has verified something very similar. He even says that we already have a base on Mars. And I'm curious, what happens when we get there? Oh, they'll introduce themselves. They'll help the settlers out.
Yeah.
But these reverse-engineered craft have been around literally for over 50 years. Roswell project, the Roswell crash, is worth studying. There are so many good books on the topic. I can mention just one in particular, Randall's UFO crash at Roswell. That actually leads you into the Corso book on the day after Roswell. And I've done extensive research on Corso's book because he got a lot of criticism for the book. And yet if you look at the technologies he's specifically talking about and introducing to the industries after he was given the project by his commander, they coincide with exactly when you find a year later the technology is being released by that industry. Night vision, various transistor technologies, cable capabilities,
lasers, amazing stuff.
Fiber optics, particular fiber optics. It's interesting to see that the technologies are available, and they become introduced through Corso's technique into industrial use. And that's our hope, too, that we can facilitate some of these classified projects to literally alleviate the global warming catastrophe that we're headed for. On our homepage, you'll see a very nice 400,000-year graph of the sea level temperature and CO2 levels that literally track each other, thanks to Dr. Jim Corum's graphing, to accommodate their amplitudes. And then all of a sudden, you can see how they map on top of each other. And literally, you can see, well, oops, CO2 is now at 400 parts per million. Wait a minute. It's never been up that high. It's only reached 300 in a half million years. What's going to happen to the other two, sea level and temperature? Well, we've already done the work and the predictions, and we're headed for a 5-degree C increase already, even if we stop emitting CO2 today. So that's our future that we're giving to our generations to come. And we're going to be denigrated seriously 100 years from now, because we can do something now, but 100 years from now, it'll be very difficult to stop a hot climate from becoming even hotter. So that's our hope, is to get clean propulsion, clean energy introduced as quickly as possible, so fossil fuel burning becomes an old-fashioned concept that literally nobody wants to bother with, because it's too expensive, it's too, and so forth. And the back-engineered projects prove that it's already possible, and that's what I'm very fascinated by. And
well, this is what's fascinating to me, is if we already have this technology in place,
Thank you. You're going to ask the same question I've heard 100 times.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
why aren't we leveraging this technology? Why are we spending billions of dollars on jet or engines when we could use something that doesn't even need fuel?
I can tell you stories of how horrible what you're describing actually has been suppressed. I have a friend, a colleague at the Department of Energy, and literally Boeing, he tells me a story. He literally told me, it's in one of my books, I described the story. And I can try another one, too, about the Air Force. But this Boeing story is Boeing developed a better laminated flow technology for the Air Force, for their planes. And Boeing appealed to their customer, the Air Force, to declassify that so Boeing could use it on their commercial jets. Guess what the answer was?
No clue.
They refused. The Air Force refused to declassify a simple improvement in laminar airflow, and it's using high voltage, of course, like the B-2 bomber uses. But this is the conundrum that the Air Force has pushed onto us, onto the civilian world, ever since around the 1940s, 1947, to be precise. Mm. I knew Frank Mead. I still know Frank Mead, who used to be the director of the Air Force Research Lab, AAFRL, a very famous lab. I met the scientists who worked under him. They all admired Frank Mead. But unfortunately, Frank was tied to doing a job that he didn't like, because every time he introduced a new technology, he got a cut in pay. It happened to him twice. He even was supposed to accept $10 million from a congressman, and he got called to the Pentagon and threatened with a court-martial. He told me to my face, he says, I can't be court-martialed. I'm a civilian PhD. All I could understand is they didn't want me to accept the money. He said, I'm a storefront. I'm just there to testify research is being done, but I'm not supposed to innovate. That was the Air Force Research Lab over 10 years ago. This is 15 years ago when he told me the story. And then he's retired now, of course, and things keep going the way they are.
Well, what are these senators saying?
The two are inextricably, and we're supposed to stay in World War II technologies for God knows how long. It doesn't make any sense.
What do the senators say when you're up against their committee and you're telling them, look, these are projects that we know about, we've verified them, we understand how these machines work, they are our machines. What are you going to do about it? Well, I guess a lot of these guys are just ignorant of it, or they know about it, and they're in the same boat that the scientists that you just explained is in, which is if they talk about it, they're in trouble.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of peer pressure, and there's a lot of threats. The black world operates through intimidation. Bob Lazar is a good example. Look at any of his videos and he'll tell you the story, what he went through. There's plenty of other people that have survived the interrogation and the threats after they've seen a UFO. I mean, that's a very common story. It's so prevalent that almost every UFO witness describes the problem of some quote-unquote government agent that approached them afterwards and said, nothing happened, you never saw this, and if you talk about it, da-da-da, you know.
Okay.
So you have to wonder how this military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about is functioning outside, you know, civilian purview. And it's because the Black Project is unaccountable, the Black Budget accountable.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about this for a minute. Okay, so there's a Black Ops group developing using very, very high-level technology, possibly Tesla, possibly reverse-engineered from ETs, that downed craft. And they're on the moon, they're on Mars, they're flying out there. Who knows if they're even communicating with other civilizations? And then here we are, and with what you say, 1950s level technology. And I think you're right. If you look at our jet engines that we still fly around in, that's pretty old technology with some improvements.
Gasoline engine, 20 or 30
yeah.
miles per gallon. Come on.
Yeah, and so give me. I mean, what is the? I mean, is it it's a one paradigm against another paradigm? How does it play out? Does it stay like this? Is this something that's just in our genes? Is this something we've been doing for decades? Why not use this advanced technology to better our planet? What's the deal?
Well, knowing that your listeners are probably a little more mystically oriented, if I may say, I could cite the Dwapara Yuga and the 24,000-year cycle of the Age of Brahma.
Oh, the Yugas,
and
yeah.
That's what I subscribe to because I'm into yoga and so forth. And,
okay.
And if you follow that 24,000-year cycle, we're just coming out of the Kali Yuga. And we're getting into the Dwapara Yuga, which is sort of a mental age a little bit. We're not into the electric. It's electric energy pretty much, and then magnetic will eventually follow. But using electricity is still in its infancy. The discovery of AC electricity is only 100 years old. And we had to fight tooth and nail to stop Edison from making everything DC. So we're today still fighting to save the environment. Look at our government, you know, trying to go backwards and stop all the clean energy from going forward. So there's a tremendous pressure, and it's probably for profit motives. It's also for security motives. You can talk to any military guy, and he'll convince you that if any of this advanced technology comes out, it's a security risk. You know, and they can imagine all kinds of scenarios where advanced technology could be used nefariously. So, unfortunately, you know, it sort of is a dark road to go down if you want to believe the security risks, and then you're faced with a primitive society, which is literally what we're living in, that's bound to the earth, even though Arthur C. Clarke said, the earth is the cradle of civilization, but mankind cannot live in the cradle forever. So I think we're going to be thing out pretty soon, especially since we're going to be up to, what, 10 billion people by 2050?
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing how population is exploding, and yet we have nowhere to go, and we're polluting the planet beyond our means to survive. So
when I study this tower, this Tesla tower, I think to myself, what a wonderful way to power things, you know?
Exactly.
And the concept is, even though it's somewhat complex, it's simple. Because all you do is put a tower in a certain distance, and then you can power the whole planet. And then those countries that are desperately poor have a way to get energy. And all of a sudden, once they have electricity, then everything changes. Then everybody can you know, be on an equal setting, you know, somewhat. You know, obviously they're not going to be like the United States, because we're the innovators, along with a number of other countries. But it's sad that they didn't take that technology, and they're not using it, because it offers such great opportunities.
Absolutely. In fact, I need to point out the November 7th explosion, very mysterious explosion at Cape Canaveral, when we were hoping that a satellite was going to be launched on the Falcon 9 by SpaceX to give free internet to Africa. And yet, when you look at the YouTube videos, there's a small drone that comes near the rocket and it explodes literally 12 hours, 6 hours before the launch was supposed to take place. And why would the rocket explode? Today, they still don't know why it exploded. But it destroyed the hope of exactly what you're talking about. You know, free access to something greater than any primitive society in Africa has already been able to get. Free internet.
Mm.
So, and you're going to give them free power too? Oh my goodness, that would empower Africa. Then what? There's a political dynamism here that I don't even want to imagine. You know, the world powers trying to imagine Africa being on par with them. I can see Trump squirming about that one.
Well, that was an upsetting explosion because, you know, those investors lost millions of dollars. And, of course, that's a Google. That was a Google satellite, wasn't it? Yeah.
I remember, yeah, Elon Musk was behind
it. Yeah, Musk was financing it, but Google, it was, yeah. So, I mean, we don't know the specifics of the technology, but what a wonderful opportunity. So, very, very strange. Tom, in the time we have left, I want you to kind of stretch your mind a little bit on Tesla. And with his extraordinary genius, it's fascinating to think how his mind worked. Would you say that he was tapping into an ancient unconscious or a world unconscious that we don't know about to create his fascinating his machines and his technology?
Oh, absolutely. I have to give Tesla a lot of credit for his ability to meditate, to introspect, to, as you pointed out earlier, unconsciously visualize every dynamic motion of the generator or motor he was building. So, you know, Einstein had this capability too. There's a book called How to Think Like Einstein on my shelf that I'm hoping to read pretty soon after I retire from the government office I work for. But it's fascinating to me that Tesla had the ability to visualize an optimistic view of humankind. And I think it was because he was a very saintly man. You know, he only worked for the good of mankind. And he even said so. You know, my inventions are for the future. My everything I do is for the future. So he knew that the present people he was dealing with could not appreciate what he did. And that's why he died a pauper, because he wasn't interested in money and profit motives, which is very rare.
Yeah. I want you to talk a little bit. I know we don't have a lot of time here, but I want you to talk a little bit about his wireless technologies. We talked about this projection of electricity and how it would power boats and airplanes and automobiles. But what other applications was he looking at when he was working on his wireless technology?
Well, the Tesla electric car, the original Tesla Pierce Arrow car, has always been a fascination of some people. And Mike Gamble, I have to give credit to for doing that research as well and coming up with an excellent article. He gave a talk at our conference on future energy, which is also futureenergy.org is our website for all these conferences that we hold annually. And the talk is entitled The Real Tesla Electric Car, and he describes the concept that not only includes the circuit diagrams, but the feasibility resonant circuitry that Mike was able to discern from the information that he researched. So even running automobiles on atmospheric energy, wireless transmitted energy, was something that Tesla experimented with.
That's amazing. What do you personally feel was his? I mean, you talk a little bit about this Adams station, which was how he powered that. Let's talk a little bit about that Niagara Falls and what he did, which is one of his accomplishments in developing power for, I guess, New York through the Adams, what was it? The Adams Point station?
Well, Adams, the director of the project, they gave him his name credit. But after 5 years, there were three plants that were built in Niagara Falls, New York, and only Adams Plant number 3 still is standing. The other two were demolished. So, and the Adams Plant that still is there is a very close replica of the other two. They have a similar style and so forth. The latest hope I've seen in the internet, and we also have a Future Energy e-news that we send out monthly. You can subscribe to it for from our website, integrityresearchinstitute.org. But we've reported on the latest attempt to purchase the building and turn it into a museum, much like they're on the Wardenclyffe Tower property on Long Island. So this was an amazing project, and what was fascinating is that he visualized the entire thing, the generators that were needed, and succeeded in producing serious amounts of kilowatts that were also transmittable by the General Electric Edison wiring back to Buffalo, New York. And literally within 1 year after that demonstration, there were many other cities throughout the nation that had similar generators developed, although they were not environmentally powered like this hydroelectric plant.
How does it actually work? Can you explain how it works? What was different about what he created compared to the other two plants?
Oh, no. The three plants were all working together.
Okay.
Yeah, they're all part of the same thing. In fact, on page 68 of my harnessing book, I went to the Niagara Falls Library and found all the original diagrams and photos and wonderful newspaper articles that, in the Niagara Gazette, that had quoted Tesla's hope for the area. And he had great predictions of how successful Niagara Falls and Buffalo would be for having cheap electricity available. But the important part is that Niagara Falls itself is on an escarpment. The river is headed toward the St. Lawrence, out to the Atlantic Ocean. It's up on a cliff, would you say. These are last ice age lakes that are feeding the river. And as they're emptying into the ocean, all of a sudden Niagara Falls is literally a cliff drop-off that is a few hundred feet high that allows for, in this case, a tunnel to be drilled so that as water is diverted into the tunnel instead and falls onto the generators, they provide sufficient water pressure to drive the generators. And that's what you see in the diagram.
Okay. And so those three plants were enough to power how many, not the whole city, but a good portion of it?
Well, in 1897, I'm looking at the original diagram, installation of Niagara Falls Power Company. They had some direct current rectification produced. Half of it was alternating current being sent to the Carbide Company, the Niagara Electric Chemical Company, the Pittsburgh something production company, Matheson Alkali Company. Those were the major recipients. And some incandescent lighting, street lights in Niagara Falls and Buffalo, literally. But that was the original distribution with 2,200 volts. And it was two-phase at the time, or might have been three-phase. But
so it was powering a lot. It was powering a lot. Yeah,
right.
Pretty amazing. All right. Well, listen, it's been fun. This book. What's the newest book? Let's see. Nikola Tesla's Electricity Unplugged: Wireless Transmission of Power as the Master of Lighting Intended. Boy, this is a big book. You really went to town on this one. It's great.
I was surprised I had so much material. I give credit to all the contributors. There's 20 different chapters. Yep. And
yeah, you actually, in the back here, Brigadier General Michael Miller, the Zanuck-Wegg breakthrough as disclosed, documented, and demonstrated by the Corum brothers will do to the electrical world what cell phones have done to the telephone industry and Wi-Fi has done to the Internet. Yet there is more. At this point in the 21st century, we are standing at a stargate into the most awesome developments in the history of civilization. The Zanuck Wave breakthrough. Well, we got to touch on that real quick because I don't know. That's fascinating. What is that?
Well, it's named after Mr. Zanuck, And you'll see pictures of him in the book. There's a few, actually two of them. One is on page 74 at a 1915 dinner of the AIEEE in honor of a German wireless expert. So Tesla is standing literally two people away. DeForest is in between, and Zenick is in the center of the photo. So Zenick was proposing this ground-based transmission, and Tesla did give him some credit. However, most biographers after that and engineers didn't understand the technology sufficiently to really emphasize Zenick's ground wave contribution.
Fascinating.
So that discovery that Quorum revitalized, and then also he shows in the appendix to his chapter the test that they did on a lake for the surface wave propagation experiment. So he has all the equations.
Go ahead. Yep.
I'm just emphasizing the fact that that the scientists have done their work to confirm Zenick's prediction.
Interesting.
And Tesla's contribution to it.
I think, and I've read this before, and you can probably comment on this as a closing statement. I think these radical technologies are going to have to be funded by innovators like Mark, who can use their own money to hire the scientists who are behind these technologies. And although this this free energy, this tower that Tesla built is gone, and we only have the records of it, it could be that somebody with the investment power could create his own community, which would be picked up and then demanded by the public, and then that's how the technology would be utilized. Would that be a good way to go about having that kind of technology?
Oh, I believe you're right. And we've had discussions about this with Quorum and other people. The introduction of wireless power in an offshore foreign country is probably preferable. And I believe that their a demonstration plant will probably be offshore for that exact reason, so that private industry can operate unimpeded and at least start the process of proving that it works without too much suppression. And this is important for the fact that government is usually far behind the innovation that even, for example, the transatlantic cable required. The only reason the transatlantic cable ever happened 100 years ago is because there was a contest and a reward for the first company or person to succeed in getting a cable across the Atlantic. So the same thing is sort of, you know, the X Prize and so forth has helped a lot in innovating technology, and that seems to be a good formula perhaps in this case too. The private industry needs to take the step, knowing that profit is available.
I didn't even think about going to another country and setting up one of these towers and having it showing them cars and boats, and God, it would be amazing to see a plane, an aeroplane powered by this unseen energy without a gas driven engine. That would be mind blowing. And it's so funny because I look at these drawings that are about this this tower, and there's pictures of planes with a antenna that receives the energy, and a car and a boat, and it would just be wonderful to see. It's like, hey, it's like, why not? Why not? That's the question.
Absolutely. We need more public to emphasize the future vision that you and I have, and then make it happen. Because the more people that visualize it and concentrate on it and, you know, do their daily actions to promote it, I think it'll start happening. It's a snowball effect. And that's what we need to create a new future instead of passively accepting or backward or retroactive, step that is actually not environmentally helpful. So, and the funny thing is, a lot of us have seen many sci-fi movies, to motivate us to sort of try to create a freeing future where space and air will be available to everyone instead of just ground-based transportation.
Mm. Yeah, it's just amazing.
Great.
Dr. Tom Vallone, it's been a pleasure. Give us the website so people can go to your website, because you got a great website.
Thanks. IntegrityResearchInstitute.org. We also have BioenergyDevice.org, which features Tesla's electrotherapy devices. There's a book called Bioelectromagnetic Healing, describes all of Tesla's high-voltage therapies and his lectures on that topic. Also, FutureEnergy.org, with one E in between, Future Energy,
okay.
For all our conferences.
What are these healing technologies that are being produced? Tell us about one of them.
Sure. The most famous and popular right now is our EM Pulsar. The EM Pulsar is designed after Dr. Glenn Gordon, the late Dr. Glenn Gordon, who used it to cure his congestive heart failure. He was a medical doctor who was scheduled for a heart transplant and lived 10 years more without a heart transplant because he invented this EM Pulsar. He called it M-Pulse, so we changed the name slightly and improved the device. It's good for so many inflammatory ailments that it activates the heat shock protein 70, which is a chaperone protein that helps any type of healing in the body. There's also a side effect, and that is it helps bones and arthritis and joints. So we've developed a pad as well that can be used at night as well to reverse osteoporosis.
So how does it work? Is it something that you hold in your hand and you direct it to the chest, or is it just something that you sit and comfortably receive energetics of some kind?
Absolutely. It's bioenergydevice.org is the website. You see pictures, videos, and Dr. Gordon describing it. It's a handheld device, pocket size. We've also introduced the EM Pulse Pad, which is a little specifically different pad wirely connected to the control box. But the important part is it's a magnetic pulsar. It's using a 100-turn coil in a very weak type of pulsation, but it's designed specifically with a nanosecond rise time. And this is Dr. Gordon's secret. He discovered that NASA had done the research to prove a very fast rise time activates the body more efficiently than, say, a sine wave or a constant magnet, like if you use a DC permanent magnet. And the important part is that it has so many wonderful healing. We have lots of testimonials on the website as well. We have people that can walk today, literally, from using the Premier Junior, for example, which is a Tesla coil you hold in your hand, and you can put it all over your body. And it activates the transmembrane potential and also provides antioxidant electrons. Electrons are the active ingredients of antioxidants. And what better way to put them into your body than with a high-voltage power source and a noble gas tube?
Those are like pretty radical technologies. Those are fascinating.
We call them experimental. That's how we get around
it. They're not FDA approved, you're saying?
Well, the FDA grandfathered the violet ray 100 years ago in the 1930s, almost 100 years ago. So the violet ray is what we patterned this after, but it's four times stronger. Instead of 10,000 volts, Premier Junior's 40,000 volts.
Amazing. That's
amazing. And we sold about 100 of them afterwards. So this is a very popular high-voltage therapy device, and it lasts for years. One-time investment. Instead of a pharmaceutical prescription, you have to buy every month.
Interesting. Yeah. And drugs are not something that we want to deal with. Tom, it's been a pleasure. We're going to have you back again. You cover so much ground, and it's great talking to you about these science apparatuses as well as Nikola Tesla. He's quite a man.
Absolutely. Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks again. So that was Tom Vallone, Dr. Tom Vallone. And boy, I would strongly urge you to go to his website and check out some of his work. The books are available on Amazon. Nikola Tesla's Electricity Unplugged, and then an interesting book that he also wrote, which has, I think, been out for a while, Harnessing the Wheelwork of Nature, Tesla's Science of Energy. And this is a book that he edited. It has a number of articles and photographs and people that followed up on Tesla, and it's quite a good book. So I would suggest you get it. Okay, that's it for this week's show. Hey, stay warm. Go out and get your thermals if you need them. I'm getting mine. And again, have a great day, and we'll talk to you next time.